Asheville Free Media at WSFMLP 103.3 FM in Asheville and at ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. This show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio, and KOWALP in Olympia, Washington. This is The Final Straw on Asheville FM. This week we're speaking with formerly incarcerated eco-anarchist Eric McDavid. Eric was released in January after 10 years of his 20 years served. Courts released him because his defense was able to show that the federal prosecutors withheld evidence in his eco-terrorism case that could have led to a not guilty verdict. More on his case at supporteric.org. On a quick note, as is mentioned later on in the conversation, Brent Betterly of the NATO 3 is slated for release from prison on April 16th of 2015, just 3 days before his birthday on the 19th. You can send him a birthday present to support his post-release life while he gets on his feet by visiting youcaring.com and searching Brent Betterly. That's better with an L-Y in the end. More about the NATO 3 entrapment case can be found at freethenato3.wordpress.com. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We're caught like a bomb! Let's talk about freedom. Have you ever thought about the way that poor, deluded hierarchs define freedom? For hierarchs, freedom and state authority go together. Freedom is reduced to a laundry list of rights, usually defined in a document that also lays out the authority of the state. As a consequence, freedom for hierarchs constitutes a handful of rights that are defined by the state, recognized by the state, and limited by the state. By the hierarch delusion, you really have no say as to what freedom of religion or the right to bear arms means. The definition of your rights is dictated by a state with Apache attack helicopters. You might otherwise have an equal voice to define your rights if only you owned your own Apache attack helicopter, if you weren't already busy paying for the one the state points at you. So, in the United States, for instance, the nation that considers itself the beacon of liberty, freedom is reduced to a small number of rights described in a document 3 centuries old, written by slave owners. I don't know, but I think any sane and serious discussion of freedom would exclude slave owners who assume to own and exploit other human beings, not allow them to monopolize discourse, which only speaks to the fact that the United States is neither sane nor serious. But we already knew that. So, in rejecting the hierarch view of freedom, as state-recognized and state-defined rights, what would a sane and serious definition of freedom look like? Myself, I like the definition of Ward Churchill offers. He proposes freedom is the absence of external regulation. The absence of external regulation. I think that serves as a working definition of freedom. Whatever sphere of life we're talking about, from religious practice to eating cookies, I'm free where I'm not subject to external regulation, where I'm left to my own devices to decide whether to pray or how many cookies to take from the cookie jar. I'm free where I'm not subject to outside interference, to external regulation. That's freedom. As an anarchist, I'm for that. I'm in support of freedom, the absence of external regulation. And not just for me, but for everyone. Freedom for everybody. As a matter of fact, by this definition of freedom, only anarchists can be for it. Consider, anarchists oppose hierarchy and oppose government. But what is government? The simplest answer is that government is the thing that governs, right? Governments govern. To govern is to regulate. So if we return to our definition that freedom is the absence of external regulation, freedom is the opposite of government, the external regulator. Government, the external regulator, is the opposing force to freedom. Where you have government, external regulation, you have an absence of freedom. Where you have freedom, you have an absence of government. Government is, everywhere by its nature, the regulator of freedom, the limiter of freedom, the absence of freedom. So if we return for a moment to the ideas held by delusion hierarchy, we see just how irrational they are. Their freedoms are defined by the documents of government, the decrees of the external regulator. They look to the enemy, the opposing force to freedom, to define their freedoms. To allow government, the external regulator, to define freedom makes about as much sense as putting John Wayne Gacy in charge of your kids. It makes as much sense as paying the bills for the Apache attack helicopter the government points at you while telling you that you're free. Freedom is the absence of external regulation. So where you are regulated, where you are governed, you are not free. What do you call people who aren't free? I call them slaves. So, you can either occupy the radical position advocated by anarchists, the absolute position, freedom, the absence of external regulation, or you can accept slavery, the compromise of freedom. You know, that irrational concept of rights dictated by slave owners 3 centuries ago. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility at Lucasville. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address at Sean Swain 243-205, P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route number 728, Lucasville, Ohio 45699. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. I'm pleased to be speaking with Eric McDavid, a formerly incarcerated green anarchist and vegan. Eric and his two co-defendants, Lauren Wiener and Zachary Jensen, were entrapped by an FBI agent provocateur who went by the name of Anna and arrested for allegedly planning to blow up cell phone towers, small dams, and a lab researching genetically modified trees. Eric was arrested in January of 2006 during an FBI raid on the cabin that Anna was providing for the four. During the court case, the government prosecutors were able to turn Zachary and Lauren against their slightly older co-defendant, Eric, with threats of spending decades of their life behind bars. So, Zachary and Lauren posed Eric as their quote-unquote leader and threw him under the bus. As a result, Eric was given a 20-year sentence for what was effectively the charge of being guilty of thought crime. After years of the appeal process, Eric's support team finally received documents from a Freedom of Information Act request or FOIA request that pointed to evidence they should have had during the trial, evidence that could have led to a not guilty verdict at the trial. Finally, on January 8th of 2015, Eric was released into the arms of supporters, family, and loved ones in Sacramento, California. Thanks a lot for chatting, Eric.
No, it's my pleasure to be here.
You've been described as a green anarchist. Do you accept that moniker, and what does it mean to you?
I accept it just because I define it pretty much as, for me personally, it's the perception of environment being the largest common denominator of whatever like social critique I kind of like adhere to and utilize. And so it's basically environment as primary concern and orientation towards like social critique.
So sort of an eco-anarchist perspective, or do you have a critique of like agriculture or industrial civilization or technology or?
My like understanding of like anarchy comes like with a full critique of like culture and society and like pretty much Western culture in total, which encompasses like all the different nodes and aspects within it. Yeah, basically a lot of the stuff like right after how folks moved in towards like domestication of themselves and everything around them.
How did you and your supporters finally get you out? And what were the conditions of your release?
How we finally got out was through the habeas appeal, which last year, and habeas is kind of like the last ditch appeal that you can use in the federal courts after your direct appeal to the circuit and then to the Supreme Court. And so both of those have gotten denied in my case, and we were on the habeas appeal, and my support team, Sacramento's Prisoner Support, had acquired these documents from a FOIA request, which hadn't existed prior, allegedly. And the funny thing was is that these are just documents that point to other documents that existed at the time during trial. And they were able to show that in the habeas appeal to the magistrate judge, whom was a little bent out of shape about it, I suppose, more so because he used to work at about the same time I went to trial for the U.S. Attorney's Office. And so he was actually going to be shoving a whole lot of negative energy into this case from their perspective. And we ended up getting a call, I want to say the beginning of November, end of October. Mark Vermillion got a call from who is one of my legal team, along with Ben Rosenfeld, got a call from the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they were like, yeah, what do you want to do? Do you want to do anything? Because you're supposed to have those things that you're pointing out in this appeal. And Mark was just kind of like, no, what do you want to do? And so they like came back at him with, we'll try and, how about we just do a cut and dry, drop everything, head out the door type deal. And then after a hearing and on the 16th of December, that's kind of where it was all leading towards.
Are there any like stipulations that you can't file lawsuits against the prosecutors for withholding evidence, or are you on any sort of like house arrest or anything like that?
Yeah, they always include, you can't sue us for anything that we might have done wrong type stuff. And of course they say it's always, you're always agreeing to this, not under any type of coercion or anything like that.
Sure, because prison doesn't count as coercion or anything like that.
No, totally. Yeah, definitely. So I've just got like pretty basic supervised release conditions. I just have to stay within the Eastern District of California. If I want to go out, I got to give notice to my PO. You got like the basic, at least 3 piss tests throughout the whole supervised release. I got 24 months of supervised release. They say if I go squeaky clean, then they'll probably drop it after 12. Let's see. You got random checks by the PO of your residence. Oh, I got the computer monitoring on my laptop for school, where you have to pay for that. I have to pay for that.
What?
Yeah. It's definitely.
Wow. Just jabbing in the needles.
You know, they try.
Your release by the state was not a statement of, it was basically saying we conducted ourselves in a poor manner during the case and withheld evidence, not this whole thing was BS and you shouldn't have been in there in the first place, right?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, they even, for that first part that you stated, they couldn't even go that far, because if they would have said that they would have done something wrong during the case, if they would have stated that in front of the court, they would have either had to like totally drop the court would have had to drop the charges due to the Brady infractions. And that was basically like the whole twist of it was around the Brady violations, where they say they've got precedent that says everything that the U.S. Attorney's Office, the government has, they have to turn over to the defense to be able to use as evidence either for or against the case. Like the transcript where that I'm pretty sure is on the website of that January 8th hearing. I mean, you can, it's really self-evident how they really try and jump around that and kind of added to the whole drama of it all. But yeah, we had no idea until like those last instance of what was going to happen. But yeah, it was quite the roller coaster ride of just still keeping that awareness around. Okay, I'm still going to be here for another 8 years, 8.5 years. And I mean, that part was always there, and just kind of, you know, what do you do with that? You just keep moving from day to day, and try and keep your body healthy, and keep your mind sharp, and keep your mind healthy, and keep soaking in all the support that kept on coming in nonstop throughout the whole process. But still, like, being open to the possibility and probability of walking out the door. I'd actually had a friend in Victorville who'd help keep that aspect alive in me, even though, like, there was just the showboating probabilities that came from the appeals process that were just pretty much a process that they had to go through. I knew they were going to get denied. But, like, he helped me, like, every few weeks he'd hit me up. He'd be like, hey, if you had to leave tomorrow, would you have everything all lined up? You ready to go? Okay, now the situation changes. Here's the different situation you're getting out. How would you have to change, like, your mindset and what your process would be in order to get out? And what would you have to handle on the outside, and how would you do that? That person really, really helped, like, build a good foundation to, like, help keep my brain sharp and my mind sharp and my heart open to, like, other options and different probabilities.
Sounds like a really good friend.
Definitely.
Can you talk a little bit about how, for people in the audience who haven't experienced prison or jail or what have you, what was your experience of relationships with other prisoners while on the inside? Did you have to deal with gangs and sectarianism and such a lot?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's just, for me, it was part and parcel throughout the whole. And the thing was, is that in the federal prison system, it's not nearly as intense and heavy as it is in the state systems. So those folks that are going through that part of the prison industrial complex, I mean, they've got to deal with a lot heavier stuff than I do, or I did. So there's definitely, like, dealing with gangs and everything. And starting out at Victorville, which was a medium security prison, if you mess up at some other medium or at a low really bad, and you get in, like, a real big fight, and then so, like, they send people to Victorville for, like, extra punishment.
Just because it was so much harder to keep your head down at Victorville, or just, like, get by, just sort of a, like, oh, well, you screwed up, let's set you up to fail type thing? Or was it that the guards were more harsh, or what?
No, the whole system at Victorville was a little bit more harsh than other medium yards. So it was that's what it was. It was a disciplinary yard. So, I mean, it was out in the middle of the desert on top of everything, and it was a part of a complex. So there's two medium yards, the penitentiary, which is one of the highest securities in the system, and then there was a camp for female folks. And so, like, the intensity at Victorville was a little bit higher than the usual medium yard, for one, because they had a bunch of folks coming down from the pen that was right next door, and so they had a high population of folks that had been dealing with that intensity for, like, 5-10 years on the yard. And then just a lot of folks that are there for disciplinary action, what they call disciplinary action. So there's, like, less resources. The cops are more assholes. The administration is worse. There's just not that much to do there for folks so far as resources and whatnot. And so with all of that as a foundation, it creates a lot stressful environment for everybody within. I think it was a couple of weeks after I got there, there was, like, a lockdown for, like, a week after two gangs got into it. And then 6 months after I got there, there was, like, a 45-minute riot on the yard, after which we were locked down for, like, a month and a half, I want to say, to 2 months. So it was a pretty active yard, and there was definitely that type of politics going on with gangs. And for me personally, being able to, like, the way that I danced with it all, I found that so long as, like, I did my program, as, like, so long as I kept to my own, like, my own program, my own routine, and just did the same thing pretty much every day. That creates a structure for other people to go off of, insofar as they know what they can see and know what you're doing throughout the day, and they know that you're not going to mess with their routine and their program. And so that creates a bit of security for them, because they get so dependent upon those types of patterns, and just in order to make the days roll into weeks, into months, into years, because that's what they have left to do. And that type of relationship to like your own routine and pattern is really highly respected, because they know that you're not like just some random cannon that might go off in their face and fuck up their program, and then they have to go to the shoe, or they might have to stab you because you're fucking up in their situation and bringing heat onto them, or any number of things. And so I saw like how just like having my daily routine and keeping to myself, and like even like hooking up with some other folks on similar routine, no matter who or like what kind of groups that there were, they just like respected me being independent and doing stuff on my own.
It seems like a lot of what you're talking about is like obviously a very stressful, I would call prisons a very stressful situation from what I understand. Mm-hmm. But and some prison reformists and prison abolitionists have pointed to the high percentages of mental health issues of people going in, and also exacerbation of mental health issues of people that are inside because of the conditions that are there, and mm-hmm. the lack of treatment. Is that something that you can comment on from what you've experienced inside?
that is prolific throughout my entire experience, to where you could see folks that had, and especially like at the last place I was at, which was a medical yard, yeah, it was definitely prolific, and there was no two ways about it. They had a whole bunch of folks that were so traumatized by the experience of prison on top of their prior traumas experienced throughout life that there was no question that like the added stressors and structure of prison did nothing but further debilitate. I mean, irregardless of like whatever type of help that they said that they were trying to do via groups or therapy, most of the time it was just over medication and the therapist trying to just get people through their program so that they could get the recognition of fulfilling program requirements and keeping numbers high in their classes so that they could keep on getting paid for their job that they weren't doing, basically. Classic bureaucracy.
Can you talk about what your support, your experience of support coming from the outside has been, and if and how it changed with the resurrection of the June 11th as the day of solidarity with long-term anarchist prisoners, including you and Marius Mason?
Yeah, the resurrection, where does that come from? Did it go away for a while? Was I gone during that?
I mean, I feel like once Jeffrey Lures was released, because that was, you know, being the original point of that, and then him saying, like, okay, well, let's reassign it to long-term eco and anarchist prisoners, and you and Marius being the top two names for that. So I guess maybe the reemergence of Rebirth or Phoenix, like rising from the flames, or I don't know.
So, like, okay.
Easter egg!
It felt like, for real, I don't know if it's just my memories faded after for so long, but it feels like every June 11th, I'd get this huge batch of letters. I mean, and that would, like, only trail off, like, maybe come, like, August, September, would it start to, like, dissipate. And pretty darn sure. And it was like when I'd gotten to prison, that was when I definitely remember that for certain. And I know you could talk to folks at SPS about this and they'd have a better like relationship to it all, because they had more like of a hands-on so far as like fundraising and direct interaction with other groups, especially around J11. So, but yeah, I mean, every June 11th, I remember Jenny from SPS talking about how those funds that were generated on June 11th were what? Sorry, the dog is just whining at the door right now.
Oh, I can hear that. Poor dog.
Sasha, come here. Come. So whenever like June 11th came around, like those funds that were generated and given at that time were pretty much what paid for like her to be able to come and see me throughout the whole year. And it was just like they'd wean off about June, and then the next June 11th would come, and then those funds would be able to would fill right back up. So yeah, no, I mean the support that came from that was phenomenal and continuous from my experience of the whole bit.
Good.
Yeah.
And like Sacramento Prisoner Support, SPS, does a really good, like PD and Jenny and the other folks that are involved in that do a phenomenal job of organizing, from my experience at least. Mm-hmm. But do you, I guess, well, and maybe you don't have any views or critiques of like how prisoner support goes in the U.S. from your experience, because you've had a good crew working on your side.
Mm. Are you posing a question?
Yes, or maybe you do. You can't see me winking at you.
Darn it, the video link.
Yeah,
is not working. All right, so
do you in fact have a critique of?
So, the most basic stuff seems like it's the most important so far as prisoner support goes, from what I experienced of it. So that like if there are differences of opinion within like the support group, they would always like contact me directly and have a conversation about it, and then it'd be like, okay, so this is like where we're at with it. How do you feel about it? We see these two different things, or four different things, or eight different things. Can you respond about this right now, or would you like to take time to think about it and then come back and hit me up? I mean, for real, it was all just the basis of healthy communication patterns and like being utilized within the group and within the group with me as well. So as long as that stuff was happening throughout the whole experience, I mean, that's how I felt, like, especially with SPS. That was one of the main like things that held everything all together in the most like effective and efficient way of just like making sure everything was covered, because we talked about everything in an open way. And so it's like after you get that covered, then everything else just kind of falls into place. It's like a Tetris game that you don't have to turn the pieces on, because you have the right foundation already set up.
Prefigurative anarchist praxis.
What?
Cool. Cool. Good to hear.
Yeah.
This is The Final Straw on Asheville FM. This week we're speaking with formerly incarcerated eco-anarchist Eric McDavid. Eric was released in January after 10 years of his 20 years served. How do you feel about the term political prisoner?
There are a couple of things on that, which, I mean, for real, when you've got the long indictment with 15 uses of the word anarchy or anarchism in that indictment, and it's not a terribly long indictment, actually. So it's like that word used at least every other page, then you have to think that there's a little bit of a political influence, mm-hmm. happenstance, maybe something happening in the indictment. And so there's that.
I detect sarcasm.
No. That's very true. I said a very true statement, and there was nothing sarcastic about it whatsoever.
Cool.
And then, like, there's also the utilization of like how is that different from folks that are like politically influenced, from a secondhand aspect, to where they're brought up in such economically deprived and neglected, or not neglected, because that actually means something else. So definitely economically, like consciously deprived areas and regions to where their option is to move outside of the legal system, which is politically in place as well. And so when those folks are put in prison, how is that not, how can that be differentiated from a political frame of reference as well? Mm-hmm. But then we've also got like, so I guess it just all depends on like your definition of political prisoner so far as like how to, and what type of framing that we're trying to use to discuss.
So how do I feel about political prisoner termage? It's kind of like, yeah, but you might as, I don't have any problem with it. It feels valid from like a basic sense. And then you can kind of go like prisoner of war too, because it's just like internal. So then how is, there's that easy translation between the two. Yeah, it's kind of there. I don't really trip on it.
Well, on the inside already, like having been convicted, how did your beliefs and your desire to live in a certain way, for instance, like your political beliefs around veganism, how did that affect, or your anarchism, how did those things affect the way that you were treated by your jailers and also by the folks around you?
By the folks around me, I mean, for most of the time, it was just like, what do you eat? How do you eat? You don't, if you don't eat meat, what do you eat? And it's just like, well, hell, I eat fucking beans and legumes and rice and fruit and nuts and vegetables and just go off with that whole like array of things. And they just go, man, I don't know how you do that. Because, I mean, I'd have to eat the soy during, like, chow. And everybody's just like, soy, yeah. And, like, I actually, like, helped out the cooks to help actually make the stuff taste pretty good at the last spot I was at. And so it was just kind of like, but every time they came at me with, like, oh, what do you eat? How do you eat that dish? Stuff's nasty. They're just kind of like, man, I didn't come here for the food.
Good point.
I did not come to prison for the food. So, you know what? For real, I have to look at it like this right now. I'm just feeding a machine. And I need these certain things, these certain aspects covered while in order to keep my body going. What are you going to do? And then, like, you also had, like, folks with perspectives on anarchism and having no clue or idea what it of anything other than just total random chaos and stuff like that. And so like trying to sit down with folks sometimes and just like being able to iterate some like very basic concepts and ideas in ways that folks could receive it. I mean, and every time I did that, I mean, folks would just kind of go, I can't really argue with that. So I mean, there was people there that are like interested in conversation, and that's always there. And like the cops, most of the time you just go, you know what, you got access to my file, go and read my file. I'm not going to talk to you. I don't need to talk to you. You don't need to talk to me. I don't care how bored you are. If you're really bored, go and talk to the file.
I seem to recall a few times of you going on hunger strike because you were being denied vegan food. Was that just based on the facilities that you were in? Like, I understand state facilities, for instance, where I think you may have been held initially. I may be totally wrong, and call me out on it, please.
I will totally.
Okay. I've heard that folks that are in state prisons and especially county jails usually have a lot of difficulty getting hold of vegan food and getting hold of supplements, and let alone being able to pay for stuff through commissary if you have to buy it separately. But can you talk about the difficulties that you've faced on the inside and what sort of came of those in terms of getting a hold of a more healthful vegan diet?
Yeah, county was the worst, definitely. Yeah, that was like where I had to do like those two hunger strikes. It was what was it? And like once I got to federal prison, I mean, actually, one of the first spot that I got to at Victorville, they had a tray of like vegetables and peanut butter sitting there waiting for me. Like before I'd even gotten off the bus. That was nice that I didn't have to deal with that once I got into the federal prison. But yeah, in counties, I mean, they're so focused on the money tunnel that they've got going that any deviation from the script is fought tooth and nail.
Just kind of another stop on the road towards dehumanization, I guess.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you got dehumanization on so many levels in this culture. It's amazing. I mean, it just manifests itself in like the militarization of the police as well.
Yeah.
And especially, and even like within like the interactions of folks, to like the jailers and whatnot, insofar as like all of the folks that were in prison with me or in the county jail with me were always, Hey CO, calling them a CO, that correctional officer. And I'm pretty sure, I don't know if this is like universal across America, but in Sac County, the sheriff's office runs the county jail, and the sheriffs, the deputies, they're not sheriffs. There's only one sheriff. The deputies have to do 2 years of work in the county jail before they can go out on the street. And so, I mean, that's part of like their process of ensuring the dehumanization part of the other from within the indoctrination of the people that become no longer people, but deputies. And all the folks that are in the cells, they interact with cops. They're just like, yeah, people that have been within the system for a while. Hey, CO. And so I was like, you know what? Fuck off that. Hey, deputy, you're not a correctional officer. You're a deputy. I'm going to call you a deputy. And some of them got pissed about it. Some of them got livid about me calling them a deputy. Others, I mean, it was just something to knock them off of their center so that there wasn't this. So I couldn't, maybe it was just so that I couldn't fall into that deep. I wasn't going to play into that dehumanization. Just to like get them out of that frame of reference of just being that screw. So like if you're constantly referred to as a screw and somebody calls you a nut, you're going to react differently.
Or both. Yeah.
You know?
So only recently in relation to the increased dialogue around the prison industrial complex in the mainstream, have I become aware that support, like political support around prisoner issues, have started engaging more actively and in the more mainstream with post-release support for the formerly incarcerated. Eric, in your experience, what sort of things should the audience members understand about the psychological effects of incarceration and post-incarceration? What sorts of things are we doing right, and what could we be doing better?
This is a really good question. And so for real, and like right at the gate, the support that I've been getting is still breathtaking. I mean, how it comes in, like on a personal level and through like different mediums, is it seriously knocks me off my feet continuously. So for me personally, the amount of the types and the amount of support that I've been getting has just been phenomenal. And it's like, maybe after a while I'll be able to find a critique for it, but right now it's just so overwhelmingly beautiful that it's hard to like conceive of critiquing it. I don't know. Maybe it's just kind of like one of those things, like when you're in the box, it's hard to see what's on the outside of the box.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Does that make sense? Maybe it's just one of those things with that.
You're getting good support and you're amazed about it, but what sort of things have you felt that you've needed support about, especially those things that could be not universalized, but, you know, the same sort of things that people who are looking to support folks who are getting out in general and sort of like look for. For instance, Brent Betterly of the NATO 3 is scheduled for release coming up. In any case, there's more information on that at freethenato3.wordpress.com. And so I'm wondering like what sort of stuff, whether or not someone's a political prisoner or and for political reasons and getting support in that way, a lot of us have, like, this is the most carceral state in the world. so many people go in or are in one stage or another, especially among marginalized communities and racialized communities and classes. What sort of things have you had to deal with that you think are like kind of universal that we should be thinking about with our community members and with our comrades and with our family members?
Okay, that's a good way of putting that. So, like, the biggest thing is dealing with the bureaucracies right when you come out, getting a driver's license again, dealing with if you have to deal with getting a car, all the stuff that comes with that, getting a job or getting back into school, having to deal with, because you have to do a full, I don't know, for Fed, you have to either go to school full time or you have to work full time or do half and half. And so dealing with those types of bureaucracies and all that comes with it. Some people do not want to mess with that ish. And it's really difficult for them, especially like in with all the PTSD that comes with getting out and coming out of the shock of the different social realms, the transition between them. And so maybe checking in with people that just get out and say like, oh, okay, so what is it? Do you need any help with like dealing with this bureaucracy or that bureaucracy or getting like food stamps or getting into like financial aid for school? And so like a lot of that stuff could be a great space to help folks out. Over the last 9 years for me, it's been like I've just been dealing with bureaucracies so damn much that it's like second nature for me now, so that I know how to deal with that in a healthy way for me, and it ends up being really efficient and yeah, just really efficient. There's nothing pleasure about dealing with bureaucracies. That could be like one of the huge stressors, a major stressor for folks just coming out. As I mean, there's the monetary stuff is always there too. Any type of buffer for folks just coming out is always like monumental. Like I got that box of vegan sausages that I've only made like a third of the way through. I got that like a week and a half after I got out, maybe that long, if not like the next week. And like, so that's okay. So now I don't have to worry about purchasing protein for the next 6 months. And that is like a huge load off of my mind. That's what like one less thing I have to worry about. And then like even like folks sending me like a letter that had like two stamps in it. That's just like sweet. And now I have a stamp to write you back and say thank you and how you doing and what's up and what do you got going on. And I also have a stamp for someone else who sent me a letter. And that's one less thing I have to worry about. And so it's just like a lot of this stuff may feel really small, but it ends up being monumental in the end of just like even the incremental small things that we support folks with.
Are there any culture shocks that you care to share, good or bad, that you've had since your release? In terms of not, I mean, you just referred to like post-incarceration, you know, like PTSD, but more like, for instance, have the vegan sausages gotten better?
Yes, they've gotten, yeah. The vegan sausages have become phenomenal. And there's one thing that keeps like hope in my heart for the human race. And I have a very contentious and very narrow definition of hope, by the way. There is still hope when humans can make vegan ice cream that tastes this good. What is impossible? Seriously, there is nothing impossible after that.
Is it like the nut based ones? Like,
no, it's every single kind I've tried so far. They're just phenomenal.
Good. I mean, I'm glad, but I'll bite since he said it's contentious and such. are there elements other than the vegan ice cream that you would like to talk about in terms of like hope? What does hope mean to you? You can pass this if you want.
No, okay. Definitely. No, I love this one because, and I have to give credit to it because the person that worded it the most beautiful way possible, is the person that wrote the Doris magazines.
Cindy Crabb?
Yes, thank cool. you. Yeah. And she talks about hope in this, oh, so beautiful way. She words it so much better than I ever could. But insofar as, like, saying that, like, hope isn't, like, this thing for me that I place this, all my energy in and just kind of, like, allow that to do whatever it is I hope to do or to accomplish. It's not anything near that. It's more like the feeling of a crush, of like having a crush on something, and like there's this idea and there's this outpouring that just comes like from everything around me and within me all at the same time towards this idea and towards this beautiful thing that I've just so deeply like fallen lustfully in love with and just can almost touch it.
And what happens without hope, do you think?
Without hope?
Mm-hmm. When you lose hope.
Oh yeah, no, don't do that. That you just don't do that. That one's not fun, because that's a downward spiral that leads to like a whole bunch of like toxicity and trauma and self-trauma especially. Yeah.
But I mean walking or like finding that there's hope and then just shifting the object of that hope from one to another seems kind of unhealthy too, in terms of not allowing yourself to feel sort of that roller coaster and also be like actively engaged in what, you know, what the next taste sensation is or whatever, you know, like,
you know what I mean? No, I hear that. I didn't say that hope was that the crush was without heartbreak.
Okay.
Yeah. No, there's definitely a balance there.
But you're just not cutting yourself off to it.
Exactly.
Okay.
There's always the possibility of heartbreak, and that's what always helps create that extra little dangerousness.
Mm-hmm. It makes it worthwhile. Yeah,
definitely.
Do you have any observations just generally on the anarchist scene upon release that are kind of a surprise? Where it's at in North America or worldwide or in your community? As far as like what the discussions are or like levels of activity or like talking to people who are maybe going through the continued post-Occupy depression or whatever.
Don't put all your bags in one basket.
I like that.
Don't ever do that. Always leave an opening. Yeah. You let go of that stuff. For real, it's done and past. And once we let go of something, we can open our hands once more and find something else to play with. And so why would you hold on to something that's not there anymore anyway? So I know it's sad and we can grieve. But I mean, seriously, let it go. Let it die. Learn from it. And then we can put our hands on something else and something new and something now instead of what was in the past.
I mean, I'm still burned from the anti-war movement, so.
You and me both. Oh. That's what opened my gates. And so, I mean, I've still got like grief from that left over, definitely. But it's just kind of like, it's definitely blossomed and developed into a new thing. And then it's definitely not what it used to be for me any longer. But like seeing stuff for real, I've been like just dialing in a little bit and getting a little bit more and more into stuff, but not terribly fast. I've got like school and everything, but I'll tell you what, I'm going to the Anarchist Book Fair in San Francisco on the 25th. I'm sure that there will be more than something after that. Oh, you know what? There was one little thing. There was one thing about like drama. Like within the milieu, and like how it's just like, oh God, there's more drama about this, drama over here about this. And I kind of like almost wanted to like reframe the idea of drama in so far as like how I like was hearing people talk about it and hearing like the relationship to it, especially in like, we're like for real. Us humans are just full of drama. I mean, it's just, there's no way to escape it. There's no way to get around it, and there's no way to avoid it. We're dramatic individuals and groups, and I mean, and in part mostly because we have like really dramatic ideas and really passionate ideas. And so like that's type of energy is bound to manifest within our relationships. And I just would really like to maybe put out there an idea around, regardless of like how much drama we create and inadvertently or whatever, that trying to move with like a consciousness about how we communicate to each other and like to ourselves and how we relate to ourselves with types of communication. I think for the drama part, which is kind of, it's never going to go away, but I think it's somewhere where we could actually just get better at being dramatic.
Community of dramaturges.
You know?
Thespians everywhere! In the streets! Yeah, no, I think...
Nah, see, you can't put a limitation on that type of potential.
Okay, okay. So, as to that last question that I was going to ask, on a more personal note, on the tongues of many anarchists in the U.S. since your case has begun was the example of Anna. She's been described in support literature as a college student who, for a paper, infiltrated anarchistic groups like Food Not Bombs and the Black Blocs during the FTAA protests in Miami in 2003. An FBI agent enrolled in the same community college course as her heard about her activities and engaged her with the FBI, leading to her meeting you, Zachary, and Lauren after attending Crime Think and other gatherings around the country and embedding herself into anarchist scenes. It's assumed by many that she's been placed into a protective custody by the FBI and possibly furnished with a new identity. Do you have any observations you'd like to make about that, or any words you'd like to broadcast to her or others who may take the same sort of path in their lives?
Not really. For real. I couldn't see anybody who'd want to take that path really listening to your program, for real. So that part feels, I don't know, a little irrelevant, but words to her, definitely not. She gets to live her life however the devil she wants to, and so long as it's away from me in as many ways as possible, there's no problem on my end whatsoever.
Was there anything that we didn't talk about that you'd want to?
Good question.
Snuck that one in.
Huh. One aspect of the use of entrapment within the legal system isn't something that's out of the norm or an oddity or just some random happenstance. Throughout my whole bid, there was nothing but that, oh damn, you got just like I did, man, you got hit just like,
yeah,
I did. Yeah, over and over and over again. Oh, your sounds just like mine, but is a little bit different on this, and so it's something that's prolific within the so-called legal system. And so like my case is definitely not special in any type of way regarding that aspect. And entrapment is used prolifically throughout the whole system.
Do you have any words for listeners about, especially young folks coming up who may not have like learned lessons that many of us have learned, at least being around for a bunch of years? Mm-hmm. Folks, yeah, who are passionate and like just how to be safe or how to be safer.
Yeah. Read history. Now, I know that that can be a hard thing to hear. But our history is really important for us to know on a very intimate level, because it's not even our history, it's our story. All of our different stories have a really profound, intimate impact on our lives that we live today. And so the greater understanding that I would have had back then of our stories, the more of a foundation I would have had to be able to look at what was going on around me at that time and to be able to orientate it and put it in a correct frame of reference instead of just being able to throw it off as, oh yeah, it's just that. That's just whatever. I'm just tripping out, if that makes sense.
So since that was kind of like, that question kind of posed the agency to younger people who are just coming up and learning stuff, or people who are new, what do you have to say to folks that have been around for a while in terms of fostering those relationships with like younger folks and like folks who are coming up who are asking them questions? What do we do? Do we point them to the history? Do we just like sit down and have the long conversations and like see what they want to know and then do our best to say like, oh yeah, I know a little bit about this. Like, here's my thoughts. How do we foster as like, I know it's going to sound funny and I'm not 40 yet, but
we're are like, you going to use the word elder?
Yes, I was.
Oh, I don't know. I'm still like debating on whether that's like an ageist term or not.
Ageist in, as in like negative to the people that are considered elders, or ageist to everyone else who's not considered an elder?
Yes.
Yes. Good answer.
I like you, Bruce.
I like you too, Eric.
there's like no like rote way to do this, and it's all going to be totally organic and created out of each individual situation. But maybe like a basic orientation to the situations that may arise could be like, of course, being aware of like healthy communication and styles of communication, and not being in the mindset that someone who may like appear younger or who wants to talk about this type of stuff is fragile in any way, so that you're not going to scare them off if you're talking about something heavy, and they're not going to be like ruined after you have this type of conversation with them.
I've made the mistake of having conversations with folks. Like there's a conspiracy trial that happened in this town after the May Day in 2010. And, you know, parts of this community have been sort of shattered, and folks who have been around for a while, especially the folks that did support or like lived with the co-defendants and of the Asheville 11, just like super paranoid about everything. And like, if we hear anything, we're just like, shut it down. Don't even talk about that. What are you doing? Are you insane? Are you a cop? Ba-da-da-da-da. Which is not helpful. And not realistic. Also, it like gives so much power or assumption of power to the state and omnipotence and stuff like that. But I guess like just having real conversations and just listening to where people are at, I guess.
Yeah. And being honest with like where you're at,
yeah,
too, with everything. If you don't feel comfortable talking about something with someone, then definitely don't do that. But don't ish on them in the process because you're not comfortable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And I mean, I can see, and like the more and more like we become aware and familiar with all these COINTELPRO practices that have continued on to this day and will continue on for a while, the more that we familiarize ourselves with it and like how they're used, for real, the more comfortable we get with how to deal with it. And so, like you said, by not dealing with it and by totally shutting down, we definitely provide the state with exactly what they are trying to do and accomplish.
Yeah.
There has to be like some medium and some comfort zone within the conveyance of trying to articulate these types of ideas in healthy ways.
And just to jump back a little bit to when I was talking about post-release, Brent Betterly is going to be released on April 16th, and his birthday is the 19th. So,
holy mackerel.
I know, it's great.
That's awesome.
Thank you so much for having a chat, Eric. Asheville Free Media at WSFM LP 103.3 FM in Asheville and at ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. This show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio, and KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington. Archives of the show can be heard a week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and we expect some feedback from you at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.